Hey everybody, it's John. I wanted to remind you that we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/alienminute. Over there on Patreon, Mitch and I discuss subjects concerning movies and television and just about anything else we want to talk about. So if you want to come over there, you can subscribe for $2 a month for one episode or $5 a month for every episode at patreon.com/alienminute. Thank you. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another AMP commentary. I'm John Engel.
And I'm Mitch Bryant.
And today we're going to be talking about John Landis' 1981 comedy horror classic, An American Werewolf in London.
Did you hear that?
I heard that.
What was it?
Could be a lot of things.
Yeah?
A coyote.
There aren't any coyotes in England.
I'm sorry I'm upsetting you, David, but you don't understand what's going on.
I understand, all right. You're one of the undead, and I'm a werewolf.
Yes, that's right.
David, stop!
I'm going to the police. Jack was right.
Jack is dead!
Yeah, Jack is dead, and six people are dead. There's going to be a full moon tonight. I'm going to the cops.
Oh, be serious, would you?
You can't let them go.
Should the world know our business? It's murder, then
murder it is.
Excuse me.
I'm a werewolf.
A werewolf?
Yes, love? A naked American man stole my balloons.
What?
It's not Jack! Right, come on!
Let me through!
Stand aside,
Jack! Let me through!
Come back! Come back!
Joining us today is the one and only Mr. Todd Norris, filmmaker, cinematographer, editor, good friend, friend of the show, nice guy.
Champion commentator. I think he's our defending champion. It's clearly done it the most, I think, of anyone.
I think you're right.
Oh, that's a,
how you doing?
I'm great. That's a great distinction. And thanks, guys, for having me on again. Especially, I think this might be my first John Landis, so I'm excited.
Oh, good.
We did right. Wait, no, you didn't. That's right. We did the John Landis quadfecta, but we did not do it with Todd. We did it with Tom Taylor.
That's right. I lobbied for it and lost.
Yeah, you had just been, gotten in ahead of you.
Yeah. But hey, I'm holding you to the idea of maybe trying to do Trading Places with everybody. That'll be great if we do it.
That's right. For Christmas.
Okay. That'll be cool. Yeah. All right. So what I would suggest you do if you really are going to sync this thing up is get through the Universal and PolyGram logos. And as soon as that PolyGram logo blinks out, hit your pause button. And that's where we'll start from. So let's just get ready to start this thing up. 3, 2, 1, go. And the first things that come up is for Jim O'Rourke, who is the producer on Schlock. And who apparently got John Landis his job on Kelly's Heroes. And it was when he was working on Kelly's Heroes that he came up with this idea of writing An American Werewolf in London. So that was 1969. I remember seeing the script not long before they started shooting it, but I remember it having on the inside page some kind of thing that said, like, any unauthorized person distributing this script will be killed. So we are starting out here in, it went to Wales and shot, even though it's supposed to be outside of, and I think it's supposed to be in the north of England, but they shot it in Wales. And I remember seeing the movie in the theater a couple of times because audiences were really going out of their minds. They were really excited by it. And it was the summer of the werewolf, or the season of the werewolf, because we had The Howling, An American Werewolf in London, and Wolfen all coming out really close to each other. And it's, I think this one is maybe the most polished of the three and arguably the one with the least amount on its mind, because I think it's a, you know, it's pretty much interested in making a universal style werewolf movie, but in a modern idiom.
Leslie Dilley, art director. I believe he did Aliens, maybe?
I think so, yeah. Aliens or Blade Runner. He worked with
that's
Ridley Scott.
Right, yeah.
I think it
is Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Shows his range.
And I didn't realize that this movie was apparently not on video for a long time. There was a big lapse where you couldn't find this movie in the 80s, late 80s and early 90s. I didn't realize that.
This opening has a lot of similarity to how John Landis opens the Twilight Zone movie with the Albert Brooks, Dan Aykroyd open, you know, just these twilighty vistas with the headlights appearing on the horizon. It's very similar.
Yeah, I always get them confused. I really do always expect, like, TV theme songs coming up, but no, that's not what it is. And Landis apparently wanted really lousy weather, so I think he got his wish. When I was a kid, we were into werewolves and vampires, largely because of two books that were at the library. The vampire one was Montague Summers' The Vampire is Kith and Kin. And The Book of Werewolves by Sabine Baring Gold was the werewolf book. And I remember reading these books over and over again. I was a real monster kid. And so I get where this movie is coming from. It has as its source much more of Universal's The Wolfman than any of these old texts about, you know, the real legends of werewolves.
Yeah, and I just watched The Wolfman, the original Universal film, for the first time last week, basically in honor of having to do this podcast and watch this movie. So
there's some good narrative parallels we can point to.
Mm-hmm. So there's David Naughton and Griffin Dunn. Griffin Dunn, I think maybe everybody knows best from After Hours, perhaps Scorsese's After Hours, where he played Paul Hackett. I love that movie. And then David Naughton's the Dr. Pepper guy.
Yeah, that's how he was famous for the Dr. Pepper commercials. But I didn't realize he's James Naughton's brother. James Naughton, who was one of the two co-stars of the Planet of the Apes TV series. He was a TV actor. They look alike.
I guess
David Naughton's first job on camera was playing an ape kid in the Planet of the Apes TV series.
So I think I knew David Naughton first from the ill-fated sitcom My Sister Sam with Pam Dauber.
Okay.
which was ill-fated because the co-star was murdered. She was the kind of the first big stalker murder. I'm forgetting her name now. The younger sister in that show was the one who got shot at her doorway by a stalker. But I remember him being in it, and I thought he was pretty milquetoast on the show, and I think he's kind of milquetoast in general. he's kind of my issue with this movie. I love this movie, but I always kind of wish somebody else was playing David.
Yeah.
I think he did just fine, though. I mean, but you're right, you know, to go from being this kind of weird pop cultural television commercial guy to then having a leading role in this, what I'm assuming was a big budget movie, was quite a leap. And then I don't think his career never quite took off.
Mm-hmm. Is there something to be had in the kind of vanilla personality of this guy and the kind of vanilla personality of one Lawrence Talbot in The Wolfman?
Maybe, but I have a little bit of trouble when he meets Ginny Agutter and things sparks start to fly, and I have a really hard time believing it. That's where I mean, he could. The parallel there could be something, you know, we could go
with.
Yeah,
what does Evelyn Ankers see in Lon Chaney Jr. In The Wolfman? So I don't know. Maybe I don't know.
Ginny Agutter's a whole other league, though. But we'll get to her when we get to her.
It seems like
I like the idea that these guys are slaughtered lambs.
Yeah,
we meet them in a truck full of lambs to the slaughter, and yeah.
I kind of feel like these two characters are kind of two halves of John Landis's personality. You know, the sort of wisecracking skeptic on one side, and then a little bit of I don't know what you would call David Naughton's character, but there seems to be a little bit of Landis in both of these guys.
Could be.
At least when I see him, you know, being interviewed back in the day, in his skinny late 70s self with the film school beard.
Have you guys ever walked into a bar to this kind of response before? Say, hey, this looks like a nice place. Walked in and it was not a nice place at all. Everybody just looked at you.
Oh my God! We walked into a bar in Havana, and I had some students with me. And it was like this, even though there was music and stuff. But everybody turned and looked and were just like, yeah, this is probably not the right bar to be in.
Right.
It was, you could feel it.
I've had a few of those in small towns, like small town bars where it's clearly, they have the dozen people that come there every night and they don't want anybody else to come
you
in.
You are not one of them.
Nope.
This scene.
They were joking that half the cast of Nickleby is in this pub. That was a big hit play that was going on in London at the time, and several of these actors are definitely were in the show.
This scene also reminds me of Pee Wee's Big Adventure when Pee Wee comes in and says, "Large Marge sent me," and they all it's the same kind of feeling.
This pentagram association with werewolves is 100% Universal Pictures. There tends to be no connection with pentagrams and werewolves in old legends. There's pentagrams in sorcery and witchcraft, but this is pure Universal. Here we've got Mr. Rumor Control from Alien 3.
That's right.
It always kind of, I find it odd that he mentions Lawrence Harvey and not Richard Widmark when he's talking about who the other people that are in the Alamo. I would definitely go to Richard Widmark first.
Yeah, that's odd. That is really odd. And apparently there are very few werewolf legends in England because the wolves were run out of England very, very quickly when the kings came to power. And so most of the European legends about werewolves come from the continent where there were a lot more wolves and the wolves hung around a lot longer, and there are still wolves in some countries.
This is kind of a funny joke.
Yeah, and it's so great that we'll just stop the plot from this sinister beat and go to a guy telling a joke.
Yeah.
It's just very, it feels like a real John Landis move, you know?
Yeah.
But then there's this awkward social time bomb kind of ticking because he keeps, Griffin Dunn's not really paying attention to the joke. He just wants to ask that question.
Yeah.
And right. I'm always like anxious about it. I'm like, don't, not now. Like, at least wait till he finishes the joke for a while. But they, it's just so strange that he just pops out with the question right now.
I've done that before.
Yeah.
I know this feeling.
Oh yeah. That's why it gives me anxiety.
Yeah. this is the first of the John Landis comic inserts that Todd and I have talked about a lot of these punctuations that are just, there's something about the way he does it and how he cuts to them and how they're so completely indifferent emotionally. Usually they're just this object.
Yeah.
But it's like he's just amazing at making that work.
Yeah, it really is a signature style of John Landis are these cuts to inanimate objects, usually for comic effect, just this sort of like moment for you to kind of go, what the, huh? Because it's such an absurd cut. You know, at least that dart hitting the board was kind of motivated by story, but
right,
but often right. There's just really no reason for these cuts at all, and they are funny.
They're like a visual rim shot.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of a joke or something.
And when I was in school shooting videos in the late 80s, boy, I ripped that idea off on about every project I did. There was always a cut to some a photo on the wall or something for no reason.
Now, Mitch, you and I, we talked about this back when we did the Quadfecta, but this plot point here, this beat where they tell them to leave, we talked about it. I kind of have an issue with it. It doesn't feel right. It feels like we got to get them out of the bar, but nobody, she's protesting it. None of them wanted to do it, it seems, like, but they just got them out the door, and now they're regretting it. It's a very strange. I don't know. We talked about it before, and I can't remember exactly what we said about it. But it is
very strange because on one hand, it's not like they're 100% behind this idea of sending these boys out knowing that they're going to die,
mm-hmm.
but because it's going to create problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like sacrificing the girls to the Minotaur or something in mythology,
right?
Because there's way more ambivalence about it.
I mean, it's clearly, it seems to me that the beat there should have been, they want to keep them there, but they feel uncomfortable and they insist on leaving. To me, that would have made more sense. Yeah. Like, I would have been buying them drinks, trying to get them drunk and then put them up for the night or something to keep this from happening. But yeah. If they insisted on going, they could, you know, go. And then she could be like, we can't just let them go alone. And then this all happens. I don't know. To me,
you're right. I think that if they had insisted on them staying, that could have freaked them out even more.
Right.
Right? And made them even more inclined to want to leave.
Yeah, so what if these are the werewolves, right? Like, yeah, what if it's right. a bar full of werewolves, for all we know? So that could have been to me, that's just it's kind of a false beat, and it sucks because it's the inciting incident of the movie. It's what propels us into what's going to become the big moment of the movie.
Well, there's two other false beats that I'm sure that we'll get to that kind of make for a weird bump in the movie.
But you know, guys, if they had just stuck to the roads and stayed off the moors, maybe they would have been fine. See, so maybe they were assuming that the Americans were smart enough to follow instructions.
Hmm. Yeah, it's the Little Red Riding Hood thing, right? Stay on the path. If you step off the path, the big bad wolf's going to get you.
All of that could have been said as the last bit of warning on the way out the door, you know, like it didn't have to be, I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting. This is like a road movie up until it isn't.
It isn't for long.
There's a real, not much longer of a road movie, but clearly that's another thing that Landis has been enamored of is the Hope and Crosby pictures.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And to a lesser degree, Abbott and Costello. But the two guys that are kind of both decent guys, one's more of a clown than the other, traveling together.
Yeah.
So this is the road to London.
I think the moment you really do know that this is a horror comedy is that moment where he says, stick to the road. Oops.
Right.
That is such a non-realistic reaction, but funny that you're like, okay.
That's a real Hope and Crosby kind of moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
That oops. Yeah.
There was an interesting cut just a second ago. I couldn't catch it to say it when it was happening, but where they walk off out of frame and then it cuts to them walking back into frame again. Did you catch that a second ago?
No, I missed it.
And because the background is basically the same, it kind of looks like they're following themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really, like, it's not overt or anything. It's just a cut there that kind of gives you this little tinge of somebody's following them, you know?
Yeah.
It happens to be them. But it's not something, you know, I don't know.
We got a little crane shot here, too, which adds some scale to things. He had a decent enough budget on this movie to do some extra stuff. Rick Baker said his first gig that he had where he actually had a crew. He had like 6 people working for him.
Hmm.
He had that Animal House cachet, I guess.
Yeah, I guess... Blues Brothers wasn't a huge hit, but it did make money, contrary to the common.
Well, didn't this one go into... I thought, for some reason, this one actually got greenlit before Blues Brothers came out.
No, I thought it this did. Was after.
Well, it came out, but I thought that in the...
Well, he showed Blues Brothers to the cops. We'll get to that, to Piccadilly. He showed the cops a cut of all the car chases, and that kind of helped get their securing Piccadilly Circus to film in. But this was pretty savage, this death, you know, and the amount of yelling and pain that these men do in this film is pretty amazing.
Yeah,
I think that stillness, and then this next shot where he looks to his side and we see share his point of view, like, all that is really surreal. And Landis has talked about how much of a fan of Buñuel he is, and this feels kind of like a Buñuel moment. It's so clear and crisp. It's that surreal quality of everything being super vivid but just incongruent.
Then I know how you guys like to talk about transitions. There's our consciousness fade to black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we have 1940s Venetian blind lighting. You know, we've definitely got a nod to the old style of horror film lighting with those slats of...
And even her very traditional nurse's outfit. Mm-hmm. There's something that feels anachronistic about about them. Feels very 1940s. And she is just stunning. Like, and, you know, we were all fans of Jenny Agutter, and we kind of always knew, and if it was a Jenny Agutter movie, you might see some skin. I mean, she was a sex symbol, and she was like the ultimate nerd fantasy girl, I think, because she was always really smart in her movies and clever and charming, and she did these genre films like this and Logan's Run. And
yeah, it's kind of ridiculous how attractive she is. It seems kind of supernatural.
So this guy, Dr. Hirsch, is, I think he's the stand-in for Claude Rains, I think. And when the story goes into a kind of B-plot, the same way in The Wolfman that Claude Rains kind of picks up the case, this guy does the same thing. So it's another parallel structurally, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, thank God this movie does have a B-plot, which it seems like a lot of modern films don't. You just sort of follow the protagonist all the way through. And, boy, can you imagine if this movie was 100% from David's perspective? It would just get excruciating.
Well, yeah, there wouldn't be enough movie there, I
right,
think,
yeah.
There's not enough to do. And so that B-plot feels very necessary. So here we're in 1981. The Steadicam is still pretty new.
Yeah.
This is not Garrett Brown operating, but it's pretty showy. And that little pullback is really interesting. Mm-hmm.
And here we have Frank Oz.
And here we have Frank Oz.
I wonder how John Landis, I never read about how he met Frank Oz. I know he's got his cameo, of course, in the beginning of the Blues Brothers, but don't know how
they all knew each other, didn't they? All those guys knew each other.
Yeah.
Well, it's all that British, I don't know. I'm trying to think, because it's all around Lucas. There's Lucas and Henson and Spielberg, and it just seems like there's this grouping of people, and then, you know, the friendship, like Spielberg shows up in the Blues Brothers as well. I just kind of figure they're just in the same circles a lot. But I don't know if it has to do with everybody was shooting in England at the time, except for, I guess, not Blues Brothers, but or Animal House. This would have been the first time Landis shot in England, I guess. But,
yeah.
But for whatever reason, I forget what the reasons were. Was it tax shelter? Was it studio, like, leasing being cheaper?
Yeah.
And all those guys were just shooting in England all the time in the late 70s and early 80s.
Mr. Kessler.
20 milligrams. Sagittal, IV, please.
I appreciate how upset you are, but this is no reason for hysterics.
It's really interesting how he uses these wide lenses in his movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the association of comedy and wide lenses, which I get, but I also just think that he manages to pack a lot into frames. And I think he has this static camera, but there's always lots of stuff going on. Like, he doesn't really move his camera that much.
No, not much. And that's one reason why those Steadicam shots through the forest in the sort of dream sequence seem so dynamic, because they're contrasted against what is otherwise a pretty static movie.
Yeah, he likes bringing people in and out of frame.
Cuts and bruises. Lost a little blood. Nothing serious. Black and blue for a while. We'll have some dueling scars to boast of.
This might be time to bring up that the director of photography of this movie, his name is Robert Painter. And he did quite a few movies after this with John Landis, including Into the Night, which I think is probably their best collaboration just in terms of lighting and look and use of lenses. It's very interesting. But what I didn't know was that Robert Painter was the guy who shot the Richard Lester parts of Superman II. So when Jeffrey Unsworth died and they reshot however much of Superman II, Robert Painter is the DP.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah.
I don't know why I assumed that David Watkins shot it or something. I don't know why, but that's interesting.
Yeah, so he also, Mitch, shot the Robert Mitchum, The Big Sleep, so.
All right, which I just watched that a couple weeks ago.
But then after this, he did Trading Places, and he shot Thriller, the music video, and Into the Night, Spies Like Us, you know, so he did a whole run with John Landis after this.
So I always got this weird John Cleese vibe from this sidekick. Is that just me, or is there is there something, I don't know why. Tall with a mustache, and I don't know.
I'm not quite sure if this works. You know, it's...
I am not either.
Yeah.
I kind of like, you know, tighten it up a little bit. I like the knocking over of the pans and then having to put them back together like a puzzle. But it should have been tighter. It shouldn't have taken quite so long, maybe.
Yeah.
So I always feel like this goes on a little long and a little awkwardly.
With this kind of straight-faced British reserve is apparently what they're kind of playing around with.
Yeah.
But again, him dropping out of frame when the camera doesn't move was pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that there's something about this deadpan camera.
And high angles like this, you know, that John Landis, more than many other directors of that era, kind of their master shots seem to be way above eye level. You know, there's
high and wide. Yeah. And then cutting from that to a low looking up shot, too. So it's pretty contrasty. Do you think we're in a set?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know we've seen the ceiling on one instance, but
I'm pretty sure that's a set, and that's probably a backdrop out the window.
That backdrop is what made me wonder, yeah.
The color scheme of this room cracks me up because it's all this, it's kind of like a pea yellow, the whole room.
Including the painting.
Yeah, and what he's wearing. I mean, there's
look at his jammies.
There's just a whole kind of weird yellow vibe.
Another interesting bit of werewolf lore is that it's not just the full moon. You have to jump into the water, and then you come out of the water as a wolf, and then at the end you got to jump back into the water to go back into being a human.
Never heard that before. Interesting.
And if you get wounded at all, even in the slightest, you'll immediately turn back into being human.
That little cut right there, that sort of the full wide shot where you see his naked body, is just such an interesting little...
Yeah, and then that when he jumps over the log, the camera seems to almost glide up with him on that jump. It just sort of suspends him in the air. Yeah. It's really interesting. So at the time, these really abrupt scares that were done entirely with editing and not with, you know, anybody jumping into the frame to scare you, although there is some of that with the wolf, audiences were really responding. Like, they jumped.
Hmm. When did you guys, what's your memory of when you first saw this?
It was in college, and I saw it on VHS, but I honestly don't remember. It was around that time.
I saw it in a theater twice in 81. I moved to California.
Laurel and Hardy comic, by the way.
Laurel and Hardy comic, Mickey Mouse and Fantasia on the wall. So this is the first of three Disney icons that will appear in this movie, which is really interesting. I'm sure that probably Disney doesn't love that now. they must have cleared everything.
I never saw this in a theater. It wasn't until VHS that I saw this. Or maybe cable. It might have been cable.
Okay, so
look,
here's
his toes in the foreground.
Yeah.
So weird.
So this is the scene I have the hardest time believing, because I would do anything she asked me to do immediately. Like, I just don't want to. Yeah. Jenny, I jump out the closed window. Okay, I'd do that. I don't see.
Yeah, but I think, you know, this is a foreshadowing of the fact that he's just has absolutely no appetite because there's something supernaturally wrong with him.
I was making a bad joke.
But no, you're right. Like, Jenny Agutter says to eat some food, you're going to eat some food.
I would.
Yeah.
I would choke it down if I had to. Also, I tried to listen to the music, what he's listening to, because there's all these needle drops to this movie, right? Very specific. But that, what he has in his headphones, it's library music.
Library
right?
music. Yeah, it's not good at all. It's really like, what a weird choice.
It's like library, like teenage show, like Patty Duke show.
Yeah.
Like library music. Hey, the kids are dancing in the living room to a record, you know?
Yeah, even classical music would have made more sense. Yeah. But why would he be listening to that?
Well, because he's a dork, I guess. That's part of it.
He's a dork. Well, you know, there's that whole video essay that's on the Arrow release about the fact that he's Jewish and he's alienated and otherized all through this. And it's really about, you know, a Jewish guy realizing he doesn't fit. I don't know what I think about it, but
who says this?
He's definitely Jewish.
I was curious, did Landis have any thoughts on that, or is that just someone sort of?
I don't know. It's an essay, but like there are multiple references to him being Jewish, and there's a menorah at the family house and all that stuff. So this is the scare that I can't believe works. Because with the sound off, it's not at all scary. But somehow the punch of the sound, right as the cut happens, really rattles everybody.
Hmm. Did you get a good look at the man who attacked you?
Doctor, I told you it wasn't a man. It was an animal, a big wolf or something, a rabid dog.
Let's have a look, shall we?
Now, Mitch, we talk sometimes about, you know, repeating yourself in a script, right? Like in the dialogue, saying things that the audience already knows. I do feel like this movie does that multiple times and I can't reckon with it from time to time. Like, why is the subject again about, you know, like it wasn't a man, it was an animal. It's like, okay, we heard you say this to this very person already once before.
Yeah.
Why aren't we cutting into the scene where we have new information that they're talking about, or just at least about the dreams or something? There's a couple of times where, well, there's two scenes with Jack that are almost the same scene to me.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you.
And I kind of wonder, I don't know. I have questions about this movie at times on the script.
Well, no, I agree with you completely, because I will make the obvious comparison to The Howling, which is a movie that seems to me to be constantly throwing new ideas at you and constantly be doing new things in scenes and creating surprising moments. And this movie doesn't. Maybe it's because it was written in 1969.
Maybe.
And maybe by the time it got made and then was eclipsed by a different kind of storytelling.
I mean, there's something relatable to, okay, we're in this character's shoes and he's trying to get people to believe him. So I don't hate it. It's not like, okay,
right.
I get it. You're pleading with this guy again, but just on a academic level,
it hasn't
screenwriting,
escalated.
You go,
you would think you would have talked about the dreams and maybe been able to really, And then you're right. And then the doctor could have said, oh, no, this is your unconscious trying to blah, blah, blah. By the way, the fact that she's reading Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court has a couple of meanings. Mm-hmm. The obvious one about him being the outsider as a character. But John Landis was trying to make a movie out of Connecticut Yankee for years and years. He had written a script, and somehow it never got made.
And the restfulness of his company, that he did all the talking. We fell together as modest people will in the tale of the herd that was being shown through.
He said in many interviews around this time that was what his next movie was going to be.
Long dissolve to the Muppets.
A long dissolve to the Muppet Show.
So we get a little more Frank Oz here, right?
Exactly, yeah. It stays on it for so long. It's really interesting. Like, all of this is really drawn out. Each one of these shots is... And this just takes forever. We're going to walk him all the way across the frame. And not pan with him, by the way. Mm-hmm. And not pan here either. What a universal Leave It to Beaver house. So these monsters are dressed as German stormtroopers.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
There's a menorah back on the mantle behind.
I was actually looking to see if there was a mezuzah there in the doorway.
Yeah,
I couldn't quite catch it.
The menorah's right back there.
Might be.
I'll tell you, this is disturbing. You know, I do remember being really affected by this.
No, that is the way in which this movie does escalate things. It gets disturbing. You start with Jack's killing, and it's like, whoa, that was kind of out of nowhere. Even though the tension was building, it's a little bit more brutal than you might expect from the movie you're watching up to that point. And then that's really messed up. That dream is, I mean, straight up shooting children, you know, with an Uzi.
And then this.
And then this.
Yeah, and that twitching's pretty rough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually his holy shit is a nice release of the tension, you know, like the awareness that that's the dream within the dream is going to freak out the audience. And you need that little moment of like, because the audience is like, holy shit.
And then you got this comic stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And you're not sure whether he would do it to you again, because he has made it pretty clear that he's not going to play in a conventional manner.
Yeah. Hand could come out from under this, you know, like, mm-hmm. really. Yeah. But nope, it's just a comic beat. The porridge is very thick.
But I'll tell you, you know, that sense of loneliness and being an outsider, you know, an American here in England and away from his family. And so then to have that moment where suddenly we see his family and then they get decimated by these monstrous Nazi stormtroopers. I mean, you can feel this sense of wanting to go home and wanting to get back to your family. And there's definitely that vibe to this film.
Yeah.
And then we get this.
I got to point out that David, you're hurting my feeling. It's an incredible line reading. I don't know what it is about the way he says, David, you're hurting my feelings. I don't know why it cracks me. Griffin Dunne is outstanding in this movie.
He's
I think
great.
He's 100% great across the board. Was he kind of out of nowhere at this point? Where did he come from?
This was his first role.
I know his family history, but I don't know. Yeah, this is his first movie?
This was his first role. Wow. Apparently, they had a gag here where he ate the toast and the toast fell out the hole.
That's right.
And they cut that out. I guess there were a fair amount of negotiations with the ratings board about things that were, and with the executives at Universal about whether it was too much.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. It's great makeup.
Oh, yeah. I want to say, I've heard Dunn talking about, he had a bit of a breakdown in the chair with Rick Baker, right? Or one of Rick Baker's people, and had to learn a hard lesson about movie life. Do you remember this? Did you hear that story too, Mitch?
Yeah, I think, didn't he pull the makeup off?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Because he lost his patience, and then that made a real problem for the next application the next day. And also he has said in interviews that he didn't really, he got tired of this very quickly. He didn't like having to be made up like this, because then he would have to walk to the set and he'd kind of have to walk through on a public street to get to where they're shooting, and he'd have all this makeup on, and he was really worried about disturbing people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was, I think he got kind of frustrated with the process. And he says that Landis kept asking him when he cast him, you're not claustrophobic, right? And he didn't understand why. And then he started to realize when he had to spend all that time in the makeup chair with, you know, casts on his face for the appliances and all sorts of stuff, that's why he was asking.
Mm.
The sinister quality is also pretty great.
Yeah.
I remember when my best friend died and I was 19 and I would have these dreams with him to the point where it was like I wanted to go to sleep more than I wanted to be awake, because I would then be able to hang out with him in these dreams. And at one point, you know, he looked at me with this very serious look and this sort of weird gleam behind his eyes and said, "Well, you know, I'm dead, don't you?" And then I didn't have any more dreams about him after that. But I always think about that moment when he says, "Beware the moon." I mean, it's just this really sinister thing. And he could be imagining it, you know, but we know we are pretty sure we're at a werewolf movie, so he's not imagining it.
Yeah. They're still doing the old trick of putting a filter on the lens for the close-ups of the woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's in that wild.
Yeah.
Who do they think they're fooling?
I don't think she needs a filter.
No, I don't think so either.
No.
At least on Star Trek, Shatner would get a filter too. So we got another walk and talk here. First one since the Moors. So do we believe she would take him home?
I mean, he's got that dorky belt from his backpack. That alone should... Come on, man. I have a hard time believing this relationship. I do. I have a hard time. I mean, I guess he's a good-looking guy and everything, but... I expect she could, you know, she could find somebody more interesting.
Okay, so this scene where we're making fun of the punks.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a funny scene? Does this work? Is this a fear of punk moment? Is this a...
I think he's kind of a doofus moment.
Thatcher's England, he has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, he doesn't But he's also just trying to make her laugh, right? Is he more specifically making fun of them or just trying to get her to laugh?
Yeah, no, I guess, he's trying to make her laugh, I guess.
That was the scene they would put in the next Dr. Pepper commercial, you know, the kind of wacky.
The punks all start singing, "I'm a Pepper."
Yeah. You know,
do we have any idea where she lives? Like what part of London this is? It just occurred to me.
I can't answer that. I've never been to London.
You've never been to London? Oh, no. I'm surprised.
No. Okay, so check out the generic Casablanca and Gone with the Wind posters on her walls, which is like a lot of people had those posters. But what does it tell us about her? In fact, I look at all of the set decorating in this apartment, and it's like, what? Who is she exactly?
Well, it bothers me a little bit because she seems to be a bit of a cinephile. Or a classic Hollywood fan. And then she kind of acts like it's dumb that he's telling her about Lon Chaney later. And so she's kind of like, huh? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute. It seems like she would know, at least be interested. I don't know. Maybe I'm misreading how she plays that scene.
No, so she's got plants in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't get a hold of who she is by this production design. Sorry.
See, I would think if you walk into the apartment, the first thing you see is classic movie posters, that maybe she would be the one to suggest the Lon Chaney. And so, you know what I mean? Like, maybe she would be the one that would know that angle more than him.
She only knows the Oliver Reed version.
Well, she does know the Oliver Reed version. That's
Hammer
true.
Version.
So she's at least cool. She knows Oliver Reed movies. Of course, you know, she's British, so. But she likes classic Hollywood, though, too. So
I know. But yeah, she has never seen The Wolfman.
Hmm.
I don't know. Be careful about that. May not be the right match.
Okay, I've got to say that it never ceases to crack me up. And you know, British people, You know, I'm not making fun of anyone. It just always cracks me up that British people literally say whilst. I don't know why. So, like, I watch Ted Lasso or whatever it is, and people say, whilst I do this, and I always think it can't be serious, but it is.
So here's how you know it's an early 80s movie, you know, when around the same time that Porky's came out. It was just, you know, you've got these moments, the long dissolves and the...
Dissolves and a lot of skin. Yeah, and apparently this was also a scene that was more explicit that they had to tussle with either the censors or with the studio over this. But I've always found these dissolve to skin montage love scenes to be just so uninvolving.
Yeah. I want there to be something that happens, not just, hey, look, they're going to do it. I kind of want there to be something that happens here. Like, she sees something about his scar or anything. But here it's just like, hey, they had sex. I'm like, okay, I could have gotten that from them just being in the shower, for one thing. You know
at least
any number of ways.
At least John Carpenter in The Fog had the intelligence to not even show it and just cut to Jamie Lee Curtis and Tom Atkins, you know,
afterwards.
Yeah. And you're just like, oh, okay.
Well, so we've got a kind of an oral sex joke coming up here, or oral sex moment, which I guess is, you know, the other version of from Carrie. There was a lot of this in movies, it seems like, in the late 70s and into the early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of stuff like this. This is kind of, I don't know, pushing the envelope, I guess.
Think of Jane Fonda in Coming Home, you know, that kind of.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, whether you buy it or not, if you just make the decision like, okay, regardless of the reality of it, if she is a character who finds him attractive and takes him home and sleeps with him, I mean, if you just give it that, then I feel like, you know, the movie works essentially after that. But you're right, the trick is, do I even buy that relationship?
Yeah.
But you kind of have to for the rest of the movie to work.
Yep.
I buy it just enough.
Here's our repulsion moment.
Yeah, this has now been outlawed, correct? The mirror trick. You can no longer legally use it in a movie, I believe.
I think so. I think there are fines associated with it.
Yeah. So here we go. This is going to be a scene that we kind of already have seen. Now let's watch it, though. Maybe there's something more to it. I don't know. It just feels redundant to me. And I like seeing his new makeup, and I like...
Yeah,
having him back on in the movie, but I kind of want this scene to escalate something and bring us more information or something.
It's really interesting conceit that, you know, even though you are dead, that the decay actually happens. You know, so that it's not like a ghost apparition where you're stuck looking the same. He's deteriorating, which is, I don't know if a movie had done that before.
What's he end up being if he never does die? Like, what if David never does die? Like, what does he end up being? Dust?
I think so. There should be a sequel where it's
just
a pile of
dust
talking to
but
him.
But he can still, he still knows he's dust. You know, it's
absolute
hell.
I'm really curious to see the Arrow transfer of this. If you are watching the Arrow transfer while we're talking, lucky you, because we're still watching the older transfer. But I guess the blacks seem to be like overcrushed in this version. And I wonder how it looks, you know, properly timed. There's been controversy, I guess, for years about this movie looking right. And supposedly the Arrow version is the Landis approved it, and it's how it's supposed to look. That's a really interesting insert. It almost doesn't read, but his thumb is about to fall off. It's just being held on there by a tiny little sliver of skin. And interesting that we've got green pillows to match his green complexion in the production design here.
So it's, you know, there definitely was thought put into the art direction and the set design of this movie. So it does make you wonder what did the choices of her apartment mean, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if it's the guy who did Blade Runner, you know, there must be a reason. But John, you're right, boy, he's saying the exact same stuff that he said in the hospital room.
I mean, what I would have done is had the other scene, I would have cut it short and had him not able to finish What are you saying? If you want to have the two scenes with Jack coming back, or three that you end up with, but if you want the second one, I would have had her walk in or something. Mm-hmm. And that could also have been an interesting cut where she walks in and Jack's not there at all. And she's like, what's going on? And some of this information hasn't come out yet because they got interrupted. So specifically him, you need to kill yourself would have been interesting. He could have suggested the werewolf angle. But having him now tell him you should kill yourself would have been a nice escalation, except he already said that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe as we said earlier, maybe this is just an older script and that wasn't the kind of thing that anybody was really thinking about. But even these kind of do you believe me scenes are kind of repetitive. Like, we have a lot of that with her already.
Mm-hmm.
At least she tries to give some explanation here psychologically.
I think the fact that she makes the Oliver Reed reference is actually supposed to be a joke, you know, or like it's sort of an inside joke.
Right. Yeah. Which, interestingly enough, that great British werewolf movie with Oliver Reed is based on a book called The Werewolf of Paris, and it takes place in Spain. And again, no English werewolves at all. So it is really unique to have an American werewolf in London, just a werewolf in London in general.
Mm-hmm. Was there just a movie called Werewolf of London? I mean, I know the song, but there was a movie, right?
No, with Henry Hull. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was the first werewolf movie at Universal. It preceded The Wolfman.
I have not seen that one.
And so I think it was based on on something else, too, and I'm not sure whether... He gets bitten in the Himalayas and then goes back to London. Mm. So, once again, the werewolves are elsewhere.
Do you think they shot these scenes on the same day as they shot the opening when they arrive?
Yep. I wouldn't be surprised.
The weather seems to match. Yeah. Then I feel like there's some rain machine going on in this next scene. I can't tell. I feel like that this might not really be rain.
Mm.
Like, I was watching it earlier and thinking, there's a little bit of extra, the light isn't quite right for an actual rainy day, and then in the distance there you can kind of see, I don't know, I see over the right there's more clouds, so maybe it is. But it's also, there's definitely fans.
Yeah, they're blowing the rain here. And I guess that statue was added by the art department, I think.
But the slaughtered lamb sign was there.
there are websites with everybody going to all the different locations where this movie was shot.
Okay. Sure. Now that's the guy from The Young Ones, right? On the left?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it is. And the other fellow on the left here is who threw the darts is he's in Gladiator.
Oh.
He orders a small Guinness and she gives him some other kind of beer, right? It's a
really
stout, but I don't know, unless it's a bottle that I don't recognize, because here in a second we'll get the label.
Right, let's have a
peek. Yeah.
Maybe it's just not the Guinness label I recognize.
There's definitely a city versus maybe country and a class difference kind of thing going on in people are ordering.
The Campari and soda.
Yeah.
Which I love. I love Campari and soda.
But who orders that on a cold, rainy day? Right. Off the moors.
It's super low in alcohol is probably the point of ordering something like that. It's barely any alcohol in it.
So this B plot, I agree with you, John. It's a welcome turn away from the single point of view, or Todd, whoever was that said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Todd did.
But it also feels a little bit to me like it's filler.
Well, it's neatly right in the middle of the movie, right? I mean, I feel like when they cut to him driving up, that's pretty much the midpoint, exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of nice at that point to get a little change of direction. I don't know. I don't know if it's... watch it as it goes along. I don't know if it's filler exactly, but somebody needs to learn the truth.
Right,
yeah.
So I think that's what, you know, we have here.
It's funny, I haven't seen The Howling in quite a while, but I remember there also being a B plot where there's a character that comes to invest, you know, like,
yeah, there's invest.
Yeah. In addition to Dee Wallace, there's a whole second set.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
Robert, a couple. Robert Picardo. It's a couple, and, yeah. Or yeah, it's not Robert.
No, it's not Picardo.
Cause
Picardo
turns
Eddie the Mangler.
That's right. Yeah,
no, it's Belinda Bulaski and the other guy whose name I can't remember.
Right.
The guy from also was a big TV guy back then. I can't, he was in lots of shows back then. But
yeah.
I can't think of his name either, but, see, I love all that stuff in The Howling. I love it when it gets detective movie for a while. I love The Howling. I might like it better than this movie. I don't know.
I think I might.
I figured
as well.
Somebody would eventually say that.
Well, they really were rivals. You know that, like, they even in, I remember the magazine coverage of both of these movies kind of pitted them against each other, and it never stopped because of their pioneering. Basically, because not only just their plot, but the Rob Bottin versus Rick Baker kind of thing is the big argument. You know, who did the werewolf better? And it's funny that John Landis and Joe Dante would then both direct segments for the Twilight Zone movie 2 years after this. So there was definitely kind of a jockeying for genre dominance between those two directors, I think.
But nobody invited Michael Wadley to
do it. No. So sad.
Although, I'll say this. We have an inspector gets decapitated later on, and that's exactly the same beat as in Wolfen. Mm. So it's weird, like, you know, these coincidences.
Is it weird that I kind of like Wolfen too? I know a lot of people say it's awful.
I
didn't think it was awful. I just saw it for the first time last year, actually. Yeah, I got that four movie Warner archive that has Innocent Blood, Wolfen, The Hunger, and Abel Ferrara's Body Snatchers on it. Hmm. And I didn't watch the Ferrer movie, but I did see, that was my first time ever seeing Wolfen. And I thought I had seen it before, but I definitely had not. But I liked
there
it.
There are
I
things to
it.
Recommend, for
it's
sure.
It's weird. It's yeah. a little off, yeah. but it's cool. Big city werewolf, you know, New York werewolf. That's kind of interesting. But then all the indigenous
Native
stuff
American
is really,
werewolf.
Really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, it doesn't really get anywhere. He gets cut off, and so that was where my filler argument kind of comes in.
Well, I mean, I think
so
the fact
it's a serious
that,
dead end.
I don't think so, because I think he says enough for the doctor to now know that there's something to it. I think that's all he really needed. Right. So when other things start coming to light, when he gets back to London, he can put it together. Mm-hmm. I don't think he had to be told specifically that he's a werewolf, but saying the moon's coming and he's going to change is probably enough. And this is also a weird beat. Why does he get locked out of the apartment? Why all that? Is it just a kind of funny beat? I'm always like, why is he locked out?
This is good. See, everybody looks at him because he's Jewish, and they could tell, and they're othering
him. These little blonde-headed girls are laughing at him.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would have been too much to have a German Shepherd barking at him, probably.
Here's a question I don't know the answer to. Is John Landis Jewish?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So. Okay, well, then.
So. Very much so.
As the screenwriter of this, then I suppose I think that makes a lot of sense.
So this is a set, right? Probably. But this obviously isn't. But I love this long lens shot after the cat hisses.
Jones, you mean?
Oh,
Jones.
Yeah.
Gorgeous shot.
Mm-hmm. That is the got to be the actor so that played pretty. Jones.
Right. Yeah.
It could be in
it
England.
Very well
it's
could
two,
be.
2 years know. Later.
So that's this is a set, right? And that's rear projection behind it?
Gosh.
Not sure. That one looked a little no, there's cars going by. Well, it could be rear projection.
Because
still,
if it's not, then they doubled the set because at a certain point you don't see that. You never see that side of the set anymore.
I feel like that might have been an actual wall at a real place, just that for that shot.
So then you have to double it, and you have to do the generic girl apartment set twice.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure you have all of the proper nondescript stuff. Third Disney reference, we got Minnie up there. So we've had Fantasia, two Mickeys, and a Minnie. So she likes Minnie Mouse, too, in addition to Gone with the Wind and Casablanca.
Okay, this stuff's funny.
It's funny. It's really weird. I mean, I kind of dig that there's in England you can just watch darts on TV. That's kind of fun. But then this whole business with this like suit model, model actress lady. Why does it go on for so long?
I don't know, but crazy. I love it.
Is she any kind of real person, or is she a made-up character for this?
Nina Carter is a real person. Okay. And apparently John Landis saw this on something like this on TV when he was in England, and he thought it was so funny that they had to, you know, do this version of it.
Just throw it in there.
Those circle wipes and those graphics. This might
it
be
got
a high,
huge laugh in the audience when we saw it in the theater.
So funny.
Here's the John Landis high angle.
Yeah. So we're in a set, obviously.
I believe so.
This is definitely a set.
Yeah.
And he just, like, the audacity to have all these moon needle drops, you know, it's just, you never could do this now. People would
just
tear you
up. Yeah, you could. They do even worse than this now.
No, they could do it, but people would not like it. People that are discriminating taste would be, like, tear them apart for it. But this movie at the time, it worked. It was fine.
They do this all the time in movies.
Yeah, in crappy movies that critics ban.
People love it. People love it when you do this. It makes them feel so clever.
I consider this an extension of the Blues Brothers, though. I mean, you know, the Blues Brothers really did revitalize soul music and rhythm and blues, you know, that kind of James Brown, Aretha Franklin stuff, because that music was dying because of the popularity of disco. And I feel like one of John Landis's missions was to bring back this old stuff, you know, because he does the needle drop in the Twilight Zone movie with the Creedence Clearwater stuff. So I don't mind it, because it seems to be doing double duty, not only for the ha-ha connection to the moon, but also just like, hey, remember this music was cool, and let's bring it back.
It seems like the 80s we will remember as an era when needle drops were everywhere, with all the teen movies and then soundtrack album tie-ins and the Big Chill soundtrack, and it was really became quite a thing. And then it made life difficult for video distribution in the 90s, because then you couldn't clear these songs that had already been used in films.
Yeah.
There are still movies that haven't come out in the United States on video because the rights clearance is such a nightmare.
Lots of television shows. Try to watch an episode of WKRP, and it's the library music just almost ruins it. Like, it's like come on, he wouldn't play that.
What do you think this kid is doing now as an adult? You know, he's
just telling people no all the time. Still,
he's probably almost 50.
Yeah. Oh Lord, yeah, he is. He's like my age. He seems to be about the age I was when this movie came out. So this is just so sudden.
Yeah.
But I love that. I love the suddenness of it. He's just like immediately in excruciating pain.
Yeah. This is well done.
Just tear the clothes off.
So we're exactly almost an hour into the movie, and this is when we get our transformation. So we're beyond the halfway point, but an hour in. Here you go.
And you can definitely tell one of Landis's goals with this is to use the modern day rating system to do what old horror movies could not do. Not just with the makeup effects, but with the nudity, you know, the sort of humiliating quality of poor David having to go through all of this.
Yeah.
Does anybody else?
Because the Wolfman always kept his pants on
and his
jacket on, and it's like it doesn't never made much sense, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it always strikes me odd that one hand transforms and the other one stays the same. Is that weird? That I think that in my, you know, I innately think there should be symmetry to the transformation. Like, if one, it just always weirds me out with that. One hand's completely done, the other one doesn't. Yeah, they finally caught up.
He's right dominant, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I guess so.
I remember
just so painful.
Pretty sure it was John Landis who would champion his own movie over The Howling, because he had the transformation happen in full lighting without a lot of, with no score to help you along and no shadows. And I guess that's true, but I still really did. The transformation in The Howling is really amazing too.
See, I think my sensibilities just run a little closer to Joe Dante's, and I appreciate the stop motion and all the stuff that he uses in The Howling. I mean, this is great. I just like the, I don't know, there's just like a little bit more variation texture to the effects in The Howling. And
the Mickey Mouse, there's our signature John Landis cut to something absurd.
Yep. Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's the one.
He also wanted a four-legged werewolf, which mm-hmm. is different than The Howling. Mm-hmm. This shot always confused me because it's so dark. It's like, why is it suddenly so dark for this mm-hmm. whole body shot? Is that poorly timed? Maybe in the Arrow version, there's no difference. But
yeah, that is weird.
It's really weird. Mm-hmm. And now it's just time to watch. Okay, look at those beautiful green fluorescents. Mm-hmm. That's what we don't see anymore, right? It's got this tungsten film, and you get those green fluorescents.
Yeah, no way to time it out in the DI because there wasn't a DI.
Nope. And I always like it when you lean into it, you know, because this stuff is all warmed up with tungsten lighting.
Yeah, I think I actually saw a reflection of one of the lights in the window, right?
Yeah, you just saw it. Yep.
Yeah, finally the movie is becoming what the audience wanted. You know, this is, for better or for worse, this is what you want to see, is mm-hmm. the unwitting victims.
Yeah, it's always that, there's that feeling like you've just seen a werewolf transformation, and then you cut to these people
yeah.
that you've never seen before, and it's just, you get this little sense of excitement. You're like, oh, yeah, they're dead. I don't know what, you know, you just have that sense of glee that hits you like... ghoulish glee that, like, oh, these people have to die. This is going to be mm-hmm. exciting.
And then her concern with hooligans is an yeah. echo of the Thatcher,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maggie Thatcher saying it was the hooligans behind the Brixton riots.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite.
I do like this that sort of friendship between the two nurses because it's this whole idea of, like, getting away with this basically sexual relationship with the patient, you know, and they've got this little yeah. secret. And because that other nurse said that she knew he was Jewish because I had a look, you know, so there's this right. kind of
transgressive pleasure
yeah.
with this stuff, which is back to that creepy, now creepier moment in The Wolfman where Larry Talbot is using Dad's telescope to peep on Evelyn Anchors.
Yeah.
And then use it as some kind of a way to get into her good graces. It's just like,
right.
Oh my God.
And so while I wouldn't necessarily call this film feminist by any means, it's nice that the female characters are allowed to have that, you know, at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to turn that around. Dun, dun, dun.
That reaction shot's really great.
Yeah. Such a strange reaction shot. Because
it's
yeah.
not really a reaction. It's just like, then you cut to this hard ringing, you know, so that's a real reaction. The ringing of the phone's the reaction.
Yeah, yeah, we can't hear it as we listen to this, but there are definitely great use to shock loud audio transitions to punctuate mm-hmm. the scares.
They got her gauzed up on that shot, too, don't they?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not even a romantic scene.
Well, you don't know. Well, you two have a history.
I think it's not.
That's why he's so concerned. So now we're listening to him tell us what we just saw.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, filler maybe a little bit.
Or is it classic? Is he just like riffing on old like Hollywood movies?
Right.
Where that's you right. would have to have this kind of an explanation.
You would. Yeah, he's the stand-in for Claude Rains. Thankfully, there's no Ralph Bellamy in this story. Kind of miss having a Maria Ospenskaya, but can't have everything.
Yeah.
But this seems like it's really just tormenting us, making us want to get back to the Wolfman. Mm-hmm. Apparently, this stuff, there was more violence shot with him killing these guys, mm-hmm. and audiences didn't like it.
Hmm.
Didn't like seeing these guys get killed, so they scaled back on it.
They like to see, like, wealthy people, you know, higher-ups get killed, but not so much.
In Thatcher's England, I'll buy that for a dollar.
I kind of feel like that's what this scene is about, is to show that the werewolf is indiscriminate, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
That you're getting this sort of cross-section of London society.
And everybody's dog in England is named Winston.
That might be the only black person in the entire movie, I think.
Yeah.
That'd be right. So right here, we're going to get Bib Fortuna from Return of the Jedi.
Oh, yeah.
That's the guy that plays Bib Fortuna.
I can see it.
And I don't remember his name right offhand.
Is that a poster for Gloria behind
him? It is a poster for Gloria. That is Jenna Rollins right there.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
There's also a poster for the porno.
Yeah,
in the hallway here.
You bet there is.
I always think that's hilarious.
You got to get that "See You Next Wednesday."
Yeah,
right up there.
I think this is a classic sequence. By the way, you know, this could be a short. This could just be a short film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this.
So, Todd, was this the first "See You Next Wednesday," or had they already said it in another Landis movie?
I think it's been another. I think it's kind of been in all of his movies, I think.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think where it is in the Blues Brothers, but I know it's there. I feel bad that I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's in the Blues Brothers. I was thinking about where is it in Animal House.
Yeah. We could look online
and find
help
us out.
Yeah. Steadicam, a little pivot. It's yawing a little bit.
It's pretty floaty. But we're still at that point where the Steadicam was new enough that this is very exciting. When we saw this in the theaters, it was really thrilling. It's funny to think that in this day and age, it's hard to imagine that something like this would be thrilling. But the camera just didn't
do
this.
There is the See You Next Wednesday mm-hmm. poster. That's great. Yeah. A nonstop orgy. Yeah, and they've got some really wide lens there. That really works.
Yeah.
It's like that tunnel shot we did, Mitch, with Damien. The real horrifying moment is... Go ahead, sorry.
No, go.
I was just going to say the real horrifying moment is when he drops his briefcase and all the stuff spills all over. You know, then it's like, oh, no. What's he going to do now? Yeah, right there. Oh, that's when you know there's no going back. That's a great shot.
Yeah, and being able to see just enough of the werewolf mm-hmm. here at the top of the frame is really sweet.
And I imagine it's probably a little bit like Jaws in that the special effects could only handle seeing it for that quick and that far away. The full four-legged
version. Well,
you
can only see the front half of it because the back half of it, the guy in the suit was using his arms as the front legs and then they had fake back legs and he was stretched out on a plank and you could only see so much of it. So this is another weird thing, is that in Altered States, which came out the same year,
that's right,
he wakes up in the zoo and he's killed a gazelle in the zoo. It's just funny that these two movies had the same
Paddy Chayefsky ripping off Landis's old script from the 60s.
Well, hey, there's an old Charlie Chaplin movie where Chaplin is inside the lion's cage, so I think they both.
It's pretty funny.
I think I've been to that zoo. I'm assuming that's the London Zoo. And I've been there, and I had one of the most disconcerting moments there. I got definitely spotted by a tiger who took me, for whatever reason, this tiger decided I was the one it was going to glare at. And I tell you, I was a little uncomfortable. It was not, there was no danger, but it was uncomfortable. Like he was just glaring at me and kind of pacing around. And I was like, I guess I was the tallest person there. I don't know. I just remember that very distinctly. Like, man, I know I'm not in danger, but this doesn't feel good. This thing, look at me like this.
I had a tiger jump at the glass window at me when I was 7 or 8 years old. Yeah, that was pretty horrifying. I had a bright yellow shirt on, and apparently the opinion was that that color attracted the tiger.
Oh, that could have. Yeah, that's one thing that could happen too. Now she's familiar.
So what should movie I know who she is now?
Yeah.
This is really funny though. I mean,
yeah. Oh, this is a great sequence.
It's a great bit. Here comes again, camera's not moving.
Right, and the land is cut to the end. That's this.
If you come over here, I'll give you a pound. It's like this kid was, well, he was taught pretty well up to the point where 2 pounds did the trick. Like I was like, oh, good boy. Yeah, definitely don't. Oh, 2 pounds. Okay. So you were just negotiating. I mean, he's going to spend a lot of time in prison.
Yeah.
If he gets caught right there.
So many layers with the joke.
Here's another great
classic shot. Like, that's a classic movement
of the camera. Yeah.
What? I wonder who that person is right there. That looks like some sort of a Landis cameo.
Yeah, no. There's been a couple. The lady in the zoo looks very familiar to me. The older lady that he ran into first. I don't know.
This and just that's demonstrates a great shot, how too. Little just, homework we did.
Yeah, I was going to do some, and I did not have time before we recorded to do any. Very early 80s, late 70s shoes and hem lines on pants.
Yeah, we're definitely in the comedy sequence of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does a good job here of actually, we've had this horrible night of slaughter, right? And then we get this comedy sequence, and then we get him walking on air bit, which you know means he's going to crash down really hard. I feel like this flows really well. Like, get the comedy, then you get this, and he's just like, as soon as he sees her, whatever went through him that, you know, has him feeling better than he's ever felt since he was in high school or whatever. This is all great to have right before he realizes what he did.
It's very much like the Cronenberg The Fly, where Jeff Goldblum, you know, at the beginning, after the transformation, feels invigorated and...
Oh, yeah.
Of course... can't last.
It is amazing how many really interesting horror movies happened in the first 5 years of the 1980s, from 80 to 85. There was just a lot of really interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kept Fangoria magazine in business.
Yeah, sure. Really.
He's here.
Is he all right? Why didn't you call me? Where was he?
He doesn't remember. He woke up at the zoo.
The zoo? Is he rational?
And so much of Rick Baker and Rob Bottin, what they did, influenced so many other things.
And to think...
And then Chris Wallace and all these other people who then...
And Rob Bottin was so young. It's ridiculous to think how much he accomplished in that first half of the 80s. And he was in his early 20s, I think.
Yeah.
Amazing.
How could you get here without any trouble?
Yes, I should think so.
I want you to bring David here straight away. I want him in my care.
So I think this is interesting. The new objective is to get David to the doctor, right? And that's what's going to drive the next movement of plot.
Well, shall I send a car?
A taxi will be faster.
I expect you shortly.
By the way, the editor of this movie, his name is Malcolm Campbell, and he has... been with Landis from the beginning. He started out as an assistant editor on Kentucky Fried Movie and Animal House and Blues Brothers. And then this was the first film where he got promoted to full editor. This is his first actual editing gig. And then he kept working with Landis all through the 80s. And he actually edited 3 episodes of the Police Squad TV series. Oh. So there you go.
Prior to this, George Folsey was editing, right?
Right. And then Folsey ended up moving up basically to being a producer on this film.
Yeah. So he would have been an assistant editor to George Folsey, so he would have known
exactly
the rhythm of John Landis, what he preferred. Because his movies are really distinct. The editing in John Landis's films is really distinct.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, this is where it starts to wobble. Like, okay, he's going to the police. He doesn't know his way around London. He's gotten out of the cab. How does he know where he's going? So that's my first question. Then the second question is, he's going to get himself arrested. And it's, you know, he doesn't. But for me, the movie, like, this is hard for me to buy all this stuff. How hard is it to get arrested? Punch the guy in the nose if you want to get arrested.
Yeah, if you're that desperate, hit him.
Hmm.
So again, this is kind of, for me, this is where the movie feels a little like it's filler.
Yeah, I mean, he could have just run off. Like, I just need to get away from you. I need to figure out what to do, and then gone and found Jack, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been that. Or called home and found Jack. Like, this just doesn't get us anywhere. It's not really funny. Maybe he thought it was funny. Do you think Landis thought this was him yelling all that stuff about Thatcher?
Yeah, and the whole,
and
I can't get myself arrested. Yeah, and the dry remark by these people. Yeah, I'm sure he thought it was all funny. And maybe it was then. I don't know. But it just always felt to me like it was treading water.
I think that's right. I think they're right outside the museum there. I think I've been there before. See, that's the other thing. It's daylight. Everything's fine for right now, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's got time.
Why doesn't he let her take him to some, like, lock him away? She just said, I can help you.
Yeah.
Her helping him could be just to lock him away somewhere for a while they try to figure out how to, I don't know.
Which happens in The Wolfman and all the subsequent Wolfman movies. Right. where Lon Chaney's always getting himself locked up. Never works, but he's always trying to get that to happen.
Now we bring back our 2 bumbling cops.
This is a funny beat here in a second. It's like he doesn't know how a door works for just a second. It's really weird. He's like, yes. And I think he expected the door to still be open for him, maybe. So he turns and then he's like, what's that? Oh, yes, the knob.
Connection between David Kessler and last night's murders. We will find him, however. I can assure you of that.
We'll find him. Not to worry. I promise.
So weird. So it's fair to say that here we are, hour and 19 minutes into the movie. So this is a new idea. I mean, I think this scene is a really terrific scene.
Mm-hmm. I like this a lot.
Family. Yeah. But it is like water to a thirsty man in the desert, as far as I'm concerned, because this movie needed another idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the seed of the idea was from the dream sequences with his family, you know, so this, again, feeling of wanting, being homesick and wanting to reconnect with his family and trying to communicate that he does love them. I mean, we know, we can sense his fate at this moment. This is him saying goodbye. Although, again, just from terms of plot, Jack has been telling him that he's got to kill himself, you know, so he's got this moral responsibility in a way to end his own life, and mm-hmm. he considers it here and can't go through with it. But I like this slow tracking shot, and I like the conversation. It feels real. This is probably the best acting that he does in this movie. It's all this phone acting here.
Mm-hmm. And it goes on long enough that you wonder if the whole scene is just going to take place like this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of welcome when it cuts inside to allow us to see a little bit more of him.
Yeah. My guess is they made a prop phone box just for this interior thing, and so that they could mm-hmm. light it, but still have the... Be interesting to know whether that's a rear projected background or if they're really... It probably is.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's just half of a phone box.
Could be.
Like where they just took the wall off one side, or that'd be easy enough to do too. Might be easy enough just to open the door.
It's just very evenly lit, though. It looks like they're in a stage.
But you have windows all around. I mean, yeah. Of course, this is not the way you kill yourself.
No.
Right? I mean, this just wouldn't do it.
I think it's funny that it's a Swiss Army knife, too. It just really goes to this idea of being the backpacker, you know, and he's got his little Boy Scout knife.
Oh, yeah. He bought that at Modell's, like, right before he left town, probably. Or wherever he would have bought. Is that stupid backpack that he...
A lot of custom signage for a movie that's probably only going to play for a week.
I don't know. It's a very popular
film. I guess
film.
So. It must have been their premiere release. The subtitles just said synthesizer.
Yeah.
But there's not a wah-wah pedal, just synthesizer.
The music is perfect.
Well, the movie's really, it's a really great, like, little porn parody.
Yeah.
Like, it is really funny.
It's funny. You can tell it's the same director of photography as the Michael Jackson Thriller video because it's lit exactly mm-hmm. the same.
Yep.
Maybe a little more backlight on Michael Jackson, but this. So that's a great. That's just got to be a complete head puppet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a puppet.
I mean, yeah, it looks fake, but still it's great. You know, especially in these days of CGI, it's cool to see something that you know was all fabricated and operated by a human being. Or probably a team. It's probably a couple people to make all that work.
Yeah, probably.
What can I say, Jack?
You don't have to say anything, David.
And you wonder if Griffin Dunn was just off camera to sort of act the dialogue or how that worked.
You look awful.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I don't know what I'm saying.
I think the fact that the first thing that David says is, great movie, you know, it's like, I think it's funny that he's still able to talk to his friend sarcastically about the... So the question is, does this scene escalate the movie, or is it redundant?
I think it escalates it in that he's face to face with victims. I think that part escalates it for him emotionally.
Yeah. If this were a marketing video for The Undead, see, this is the testimonial part, you know, to convince you of the objective to kill yourself. Like, we've got testimonials from your victims to hammer the point home.
Yeah, it's a good idea. It takes a bit to get there, but I agree. Mm-hmm. Once it starts, this is pretty cool.
It does. It's a little long, but it's, you know, you've got the sort of the rational, cold guy from the subway, and then you've got the giddy, oblivious couple, and then the angry homeless folks, you know, that really hate the guy. It also is funny how the moans from the porno film are punctuating the deadly serious lines of dialogue undercutting it all.
It's pretty gleeful about being able to get away with all this. You know, this is nice that it's we're in an R-rated world,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's rare these days. If I see a horror film is rated PG-13, odds are I won't even watch it because yeah. I know that it's not going to push any envelopes in any direction.
It does. But John, your question about if he continues to decompose, what does happen? I guess, yeah, right. It would just be a pile of dust. This may be their last meeting.
He'll have no tissue to hold his jaw into place mm-hmm. the next right. time. And his fingers will have fallen off so he can't do sign language. So this may be the last conversation that the two of them could ever have. So apparently, in order to be able to film two nights Piccadilly Circus for a few hours each night, which had never been done before, let alone with all these crashes and car stuff, he apparently showed the Blues Brothers to a bunch of police, and they were impressed with all of the stunt work and car stuff, and they said, okay, you can do it.
Wow.
That's the story.
There is some really dangerous stunt work going on in that scene mm-hmm. when we get there. I'll just like lay that down. That I hate to say kind of presages his willing to risk certain people's. Yeah. I mean, there's one stunt in particular that I just don't see how it didn't end in an injury. Maybe two of them coming up here pretty soon.
Yeah, this is a really
how do you top the Blues Brothers? You know, that's the challenge.
Right. Yeah. The phone call. Yeah, it really does get horrifying here. I had just watched this last moments right before this podcast, and boy, I had forgotten how unsettling and over the top violent it is. And yeah, John, the stunt work is that's another layer of scariness to it.
I haven't seen Into the Night in a long time, but I remember when I saw it thinking that it's pretty violent too, right?
Yeah, at the very end, yeah.
Very, very unrepentant.
The end of it is very violent. Kind of,
yeah.
It almost like jumps out of itself in a way. It gets so violent at the end that it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like, where did this come from?
The wolf is almost cute.
Yeah, it has almost feline looking
yeah.
face in that shot there.
I like that low angle right there.
I do too, and I like the idea that these guys are going to try to hold this thing back, mm-hmm. and that they're running toward it.
There's
and
definitely
getting closer.
There's echoes of King Kong here. You know, this thing has come to the city, and it can't be contained, yeah. and it's about to escape and unleash its fury all over the city. Yeah.
So, yeah, the way that this guy goes down is exactly, he even looks like the guy in Wolfen.
And I just love how quickly it happens.
They both meet the same fate.
It's like he's just immediately decapitated. It's insane.
On the soundtrack, I love the snapping of his jaws, too, of the wolf. Every time his mouth closes, there's a really hard snap. Yeah, that's rough.
Just being really hard on people. But those weren't... There's a stunt coming up where somebody gets hit by a car and thrown through a window.
That's John Landis. That's John Landis right there.
I mean, that's... That was John Landis getting hit by the car?
Yeah. He did that stunt. Yeah, that's him.
Wow, that's crazy. Because it looks really painful. That one right there really too. I mean, I'm sure that the car stopped before it hit that cop, but it. What if it didn't?
But they all have these really violent ideas driving the stunt, and that's that's impressive. And we're through it now. That was it. That was the carnage, pretty much.
And then Kyle Reese drops out of the sky and from the future right here.
It does kind of look like that.
I'm amazed how fast that the doctor and Alex get down here.
Yeah, they're in they're in shape, you know.
All that
walking at the hospital.
Well, everything kind of speeds up at the end here. I've always felt that maybe it could have used a little bit of breathing room, but everything gets all kind of sudden and abrupt here at the end. The ending specifically itself.
I think it's just like sudden. Whoa. Sudden and abrupt for a sudden and abrupt ending, because the ending is so shocking. It's so over instantly that, like, I kind of, it's very punk rock. I kind of give it credit for being so non-emotional and so cold. And even though you have that one moment where their eyes meet and you kind of have this connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a nasty ending. It's a screw you to the audience for sure.
And then we're going to get our guys. These guys are extras from that Angelina Jolie movie where they were able to bend the bullets. You remember that?
Wanted.
Stupid action. Is that what it was called? Yeah. I couldn't even remember. All I ever think here is, like, how did they shoot that wolf and not shoot her?
Yeah, like, really.
It's just like an incredible bit of marksmanship.
That is true.
All I can figure is that they must bend bullets like Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, because she didn't drop or anything, does she?
Mm-mm.
No.
It's movie geography.
Maybe he ran past her. Maybe when he charges and runs past her.
I don't think so, because when you see the eye lines and everything, she's definitely looking at him.
No, I know.
You're right. It makes no sense now that I think about it. Do you think the audience even anticipates that this is the end is so near?
When I saw it, in the theater, everybody was shocked.
Yeah,
it was over so fast, and then it doubles down on it by the music, what the music does.
Yeah,
which is kind of a ha ha gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's just standing there, man.
Yep. Yeah, it is pretty. It is nice though, because you often get that feeling that. You know when the movie's going to end, and it's nice to be surprised a little bit.
Yeah, you would think there'll be a tag or something, or one more shot back. And then that's it.
Yeah, that last shot. I wonder if it even lasts a second. It's very fast.
Pretty snotty. Well, there we go. That brings us to the end of this extraordinary experience. Todd, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you out there in Patreon land.
I feel like there was somebody that we were trying to figure out who they were, and now I don't.
See you next Wednesday, cast.
Brenda Bristles.
I did notice that Landis didn't give himself credit for that stunt, so he's not listed with the stunt team, but he did that stunt.
In the See You Next Wednesday, the woman's name was Georgia Bailey, and I wonder is that a joke on George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life?
I wondered if
it
was, because the other one was Lance Boyle. So, yeah, kind of.
Lance Boyle, God.
So I guess next up for John Landis would be the Thriller music video.
No, it'd be Twilight Zone, I think.
He did that at, really? He did. He, I think.
Pretty,
he,
yeah, I, some. Pretty I sure he did.
I think he did Thriller before, but I will have to check.
I think he did a whole lot of work after Twilight Zone that he shouldn't have been doing, probably.
Right.
I'm pretty sure Thriller's one of those.
Yeah. At least on IMDb, Trading Places and Twilight Zone, the movie, come first, and then Michael Jackson Thriller is after that.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay. Well, that's it, I think. I think we're finished, right, John?
Yeah, I mean, we could just keep talking through the credits.
Last of the credits, because producer's secretary needs a credit.
The best boy was Alan Berry, and we might. I do think, you know, we did Die Hard last year for Christmas. Maybe we'll do Trading Places. Just do another Landis. But I'll tell you, if we do Trading Places, I'll probably talk about other filmmakers more than John Landis. Some more classic Hollywood people that I think he's riffing off of.
Oh, I think so too.
For Trading Places, so.
That'll definitely be part of the conversation.
Yeah. Jim Henson with a thank you. Mr. Jim Henson.
Miko's impressions of an American Werewolf in London. Miko just can't, you know, can't get enough Miko.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I never saw this before.
That. Oh my
that's,
God.
That's
what are they doing?
Wild.
I had no idea that was there.
I forgot about that. I remember that in the movie theaters, but I didn't take it all the way to the end. So
I remember watching that at my grandma's house. So that was it was such a huge deal at the time when that happened, but I wouldn't have guessed somebody would congratulate them on their movie.
It's a one more snotty move probably.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
That'll do it. Thanks, folks. Okay. See you next time.